are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, May 22, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, investigative journalist Yasha Levine on his book, Surveillance Valley, The Secret Military History of the Internet. Meanwhile, the clown prince's crown prince problem. DOJ officials proclaim we are finally a banana republic. And remember when the country was obsessed with the Secretary of State's cell phone security?
I do remember Solyndra.
Meet Donald Trump.
What?
Speaking of Donald Trump, he meets with the South Korean president and has a SAD. And meanwhile, South Korea blames John Bolton. And Mike Pompeo tries to make Iran the good war. Out of Charlottesville, the third white supremacist found guilty of a beating of an African-American man during those protests. Speaking of protests, conservatives threaten Netflix with a boycott. Thanks, Obama.
That's great, really?
Yeah. Yep. Neil Gorsuch makes wage stealing great again. And it is primary day in Texas, Georgia, Kentucky, and Arkansas. And later on this program, a little bonus, folks. Cliff Schechter will be here for a couple minutes to talk about a new project he's working on that targets about a dozen Republican congressmen across the country. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is Tuesday in the era of the Trump malaise, where every day brings just another moment of, are you effing kidding me? Seriously, I can't digest this. I mean, I am literally just today am getting confused between the multiple stories of absurd levels of corruption that just involved Jared Kushner and the UAE. That's like you can actually like you could filter these things out and just have multiple tags on all of these stories of corruption. But And it really, in many respects, I mean, goes back to what we had talked about in the early days of the administration, frankly, even in the election, that it was really just a scam to begin with. And, you know, for those libertarians, they don't seem to exist anymore. They're all now just sort of classical liberals.
Pepes.
Who are exactly.
Or Nazis.
Classical Pepes. Who used to call into this program and say, you know, we need to, they're really neo-Confederates, but they would present themselves as libertarians. And frankly, that's not particularly better in my mind, but for whatever reason, sounded more intellectual, I guess, to them. And they would argue, you know, we need to have all government localized because they don't want the federal government to exist for a myriad of reasons. But one was because of, you know, major corporations are corrupting our federal government. Understand that when we see this level of corruption out of the presidency, and I'm not saying that there isn't always been a quality of our corruption where, you know, you steal a little bit, they put you in jail, steal a lot, and they make you king type of situation. But the depth of corruption that has come to the White House and therefore through the executive agencies, right? You see it with every, in fact, I think I've been asking for a long time, why is Scott Pruitt still on the job? And I think it's because he's the most corrupt. Like, you know, that's it. It's just a matter of respect.
He just comes through. I mean, the thing is that pound, pound, exactly. Pound, Scott shows up.
There's never a day where he doesn't leverage.
At first
and
we
so,
thought,
boom.
It's the airline tickets. We're going to fire him. Then he comes through with an apartment. It's impressive.
It's impressive stuff. And but that what we're seeing is the corruption that Donald Trump exercised in New York real estate, i.e. paying off government officials, contributing to, like he said during the campaign, you know, I'd give a bunch of money to everybody and they'd always take my call. That is a localized form of corruption. If you've ever lived in like a small town, you know that the people who get on the town council are doing it because like this is the way they're going to get the zoning for their car dealership. This is the way they're going to get the low interest loan that the county is offering for their buddy who owns a restaurant supply business, whatever it is. And where people enter into government in the same way that they would, you know, sit on the board of the United Way. It's a network play. And I just going to leverage these relationships. And when they enter into government, they're just going to leverage everything. And that's what we're witnessing now. And it's really almost, at one point it just floods the zone. And you can't, you know, there are countries and at various times it changes and then maybe circles back where you can't really even talk about corruption because that implies that there is a system that functions without corruption that has been corrupted, right? Like there's a host that in some way has been degraded. But there are just systems where it's you can't refer to it as corrupt. It's simply the way business is done, the way government works. You want your potholes filled? Well, you got to pay and add a little bit extra to the Department of Public Works. And that seems to be what's going on in the, you know, with the White House. And, you know, I think another explanation for why Robert Mueller has taken at least a year for this investigation is that every day they find more and more stuff and they just simply don't have the budget to hire the 50 other people they need to process it. And I will also add, this stuff was obviously going on before, maybe not directly out of the White House, but you have a whole host of a segment of society that has basically gotten away with all of this, which is why they're so brazen about it. Because there was never any reckoning, no accountability. But that is the era we're living in now, this sort of a level of corruptness that we can't, that's almost hard to express. And so when you see a Betsy DeVos, who is a billionaire and whose brother, Eric Prince, is intricately involved in some of the corruption that involves Saudi Arabia and the UAE and God knows where else. You remember he pitched, and I can't remember who it was he pitched it with, but basically as a to be hired as a mercenary force to basically be the provisional authority in Afghanistan.
Bannon.
With Bannon. And, it's just a matter until he, you know, we got to wait until, I guess, Thanksgiving when the DeVos family gets together and Eric Prince is there. And then all of a sudden we're going to have our school safety systems manned by Xi or whatever they're calling their mercenary squad now. But Betsy DeVos was in front of the House Education and Workforce Committee. And What you're about to witness is someone who doesn't know what she's talking about, who has been raised in such a bubble that she's never had to account for what she doesn't know what she's talking about, who knows that the person who is asking her questions knows that she doesn't know what she's talking about and doesn't give a F because she just doesn't care. And so she's just going to repeat some words over and over again and just get through this. But it is indicative of what's going on. And just, you know, contemplate what it would be like to actually work in the Department of Education with Betsy DeVos as the head of it. And you went in there as a career civil servant to ostensibly help the nation's education system. Listen to this.
Madam Secretary, the Prosper Act provides for a $15 billion cut in student aid. Is that right?
Pause it for 1 second. I should say that it's Bobby Scott, a Democrat from Virginia, who is asking her questions about a specific program that has been earmarked for cuts. So just start from the beginning.
Madam Secretary, the Prosper Act provides for a $15 billion cut in student aid. Is that right?
I've heard that opined. I'm not sure I agree with that, but...
Do you have another number?
Pardon me?
Do you have another number?
It's an approach to giving students much more flexibility pursuing their higher education.
$15 billion cut. Is that... Do you have another number?
I have heard that opined that that is the case. I said I don't necessarily share that perspective.
She would not share her perspective either. Like, presumably, if your response is, well, yeah, some people read that as a $15 billion cut, but I don't agree with that. Okay, what number would you have? A different number. She said a different number at that point.
She did not even say a different number.
She said it's a method.
It's a method.
This goes back to what I was trying to say before, and you all looked at me like I was crazy. But I don't think it's that she's bad at her job. She's really good at the real job that she's been hired to do, which is destroy public education. She just can't say that out loud. So, you know, she's going to smile through this charade of public accountability and then do exactly what she was hired to do.
Oh, well, there's no doubt. There's no doubt that she's effective in. But I don't think that she even knows in this instance. I don't think she has a number.
There's no contribution.
Like,
it's
not relevant to the real job that she's doing.
Well, but the real job that she's doing, she wants to drain money out of that system. Or maybe she does have a number then.
She does. She knows she's draining money. She's feigning this air of not knowing anything.
There's no doubt in my mind she knows she's draining money, but I also think that she's operating on such a level of generalities at that department that she is not getting into any of the details.
I would like to opine for a second. You're both right. I am both completely unable to do the job. As an example, I say, let's get rid of rape restrictions on the campuses, and then someone else fills in the details.
I honestly don't even know that she gets that granular let's just get out of the business.
Right.
Period.
And that's the conservative viewpoint.
Yep.
That's it.
And she's got many years of track record in doing that, in privatizing education.
Absolutely. But for her, I think it was just like she hires some political director and says, here's X number of dollars. I want, me and my husband believe that God has said there shouldn't be public schools. And please design a system to filter more taxpayer dollars to parochial schools.
Yeah, she's delegating.
Exactly.
Betsy the Boss DeVos.
Boom. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, Yasha Levine on Surveillance Valley, the secret military history of the internet.
Dinosaur.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program investigative journalist and author of Surveillance Valley, The Secret Military History of the Internet, Yasha Levine. Yasha, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. So now, the Reader's Digest version of the Internet is that Al Gore helped, our military, or I guess it was DARPA, develop it. But it actually started earlier than that, back in the late 50s.
Yeah. I mean, Al Gore created it with his mind from the womb, you know, when he was still developing as a fetus. He was already creating it. No, I mean, look, it started in the 50s as a military project that had its roots in air defense on some level, right? Early warning radar defense system for the United States to protect America from a Soviet nuclear attack by air. And so in the 50s, this entailed creating this first modern computerized radar defense system that featured these giant IBM computers spread around all over America in these nuclear-proof bunkers, and connecting them with a network, and then creating technology that was this first generation kind of workspace desktop computer technology that allowed people watching the radar screen to interact with a digital screen with an early mouse and kind of open menus and things like that. So that was the first national network. And out of that, in the 1960s, during the Vietnam War, began the development of the ARPANET, the military network that later on became the Internet. During the Vietnam War, it had less to do with air defense and more to do with finding ways of fighting insurgencies and figuring out a new kind of approach to fighting warfare, where you're dealing with an unknown kind of battlefield, a different type of enemy that's hiding in plain sight, hiding in among local population in Vietnam and different insurgencies around the world, and figuring out ways of how do you find the insurgent in the civilian population? How do we figure out why they're fighting us, why they're fighting America? So the idea was to study this information, to study culture, study people, and to try to isolate the radical part of the population from the more complacent part, and figure out what makes people tick. And so the system that we now know as the Internet was a kind of a foundation that allowed the Pentagon and allowed intelligence agencies to share information that they were collecting from around the world, and to analyze it and to try to help them run and manage a global presence in the age of insurgencies, in the age of nuclear warfare, to get like a bird's eye view of the world.
And so that particular program was the Cambridge Project, right? And this was done out of DARPA. And we should just say that ARPA was the Advanced Research Project Agency, and then it ultimately became DARPA, which I think gives you a sense of like where all of this is heading, right? I mean, at one point it's just research, and then it becomes about brought into the State Department. I mean, so and this was under McNamara, had obviously a big reputation as being a data guy, I guess. And I mean, just break it down for us a little bit more. Like, how was this supposed to? How were they hoping, and did it work? This Cambridge Project, that they would be able to isolate where the insurgency, in quotations, is coming from.
Well, yeah. Look, I mean, the Cambridge Project that you're talking about is actually just a kind of an offshoot of the larger ARPANET project that was run out of ARPA, and there were a number of different projects, and this one was specifically geared at creating a networked sort of infrastructure, a set of tools, a set of databases that could ingest large amounts of data into a computer, into a computer database, and be easy enough to use that anyone could do it, right? That you didn't need specialized training. You didn't need to be a technician in a white lab coat that's, you know, punching IBM cards and then feeding them into a computer, which is how data was fed into computers. And even still then, this is the late 60s. And so it was trying to come up with, a modern database, a suite of database applications. And that could allow, the processing of data, of any kind of data. It could be, weather data, for instance, but it could also be data on individuals, let's say anti-war protesters, data on civil rights protesters, data on, the communist movement in Latin America, or communist movements in Latin America. It could be a database of, foreign intelligence intercepts that could be, for instance, fed into this digitized and searched by anybody connected to the ARPANET network. And so they were trying to. The Cambridge Project was, I guess, like an early version of what Palantir is trying to do now, right? Which is give people a tool or a set of tools that can ingest any kind of data, mash it all together, and use it for whatever purposes they have in mind. Whether that's, analyzing, Wall Street data so you can get the drop on other firms and make investments, right, before the market moves on them, or you're the CIA and you're trying to comb through phone records, internet records and things like that to find some kind of terrorist network, right? So it's actually, the tool would be agnostic in the sense that it didn't care what kind of data you fed into it, right?
Right.
But, because it was connected to the ARPANET and it was being funded by the Pentagon and funded under a military umbrella, the selling point of this particular project that was connected to the ARPANET was that it would give intelligence analysts and military analysts a broad set of generic tools that could allow them to work with data and to use data for whatever purposes they had in mind. And so at the time, when this thing was built, it was started in the late 60s and it ran through the 70s, and the CIA at the time, called it the most sophisticated data analysis tool that is available to CIA analysts. So you have to remember that computers, general purpose computers, didn't really exist back then. General purpose software like Excel spreadsheets and database software didn't exist back then. And so ARPA, and as part of its ARPANET project, was really tasked with developing these things. And so most of the personal computer technology that we're used to today, the desktop computer, the word processor, the database software, the Excel spreadsheet, even like collaborative document editing now that you get with Google Docs and things like that, video conferencing software, that was all developed by ARPA as part of its ARPANET program that then gave us the internet. And so these things are kind of come together. And so, but your other question is, how are they hoping to use this, right? How were they using data at the time, right?
Right.
And I mean, you kind of have to go back in time to the 1960s to understand why they were pursuing this technology. America was, a globally expanding power at the time. It was still kind of new. It was fighting the Soviet Union and this nuclear standoff, but it was also fighting these insurgencies all around the globe. The Vietnam War was central in that, but there were insurgencies that America was involved in, or trying to fight insurgencies, all around the globe, Latin America, in the Middle East, in Africa. And this is a new kind of warfare because it didn't involve, tanks. It didn't involve, armies with people marching in, formation. So you couldn't really fight it in the same way that you'd fight World War II or the Korean War. This is a warfare that had combatants that were part of the civilian population, and it was not easy to even find out who they were or why they were fighting, what their motivations were. These are regions in which America sometimes didn't really have a historic presence, so they didn't really understand the people it was fighting and who they were. What was causing all of this was kind of naive in that sense, and so they believed that if you could understand, if you could gather data about these people, right, about these political movements, about what they believed, what they wanted, about their cultural values, you could more effectively fight them and defeat them on the battlefield, on this new kind of battlefield.
Right. I mean, this is the way they win hearts and minds, right? Like, who knew you needed a computer to tell you that people didn't like to be bombed or something to that effect, I guess. But it's So let me ask you, at this time, were there any private applications of this, essentially this large machine? Were private actors allowed into the system? I mean, at what point does, and I know that as we move into the 70s and we start to have, personal computers, essentially, early stage. I mean, I, you know, am old enough to know that in high school, the closest that we had to personal computers was basically a typewriter that had an extended monitor, was really, and then you could actually save some data. So I guess it was some computing, but, But was there at that time any private entities that were in any way accessing this stuff or using it, or how did that sort of integration happen?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, it's a good question. I think almost immediately when ARPANET technology, this internet technology, was demonstrated and it began to connect these different research centers and military contractors around the country, and it was began to be used to develop new kind of technologies and tools for the military. People who were involved in building this for ARPA, you know, left and set up their own shop and set up their own networking companies that offered this to corporations, offered this technology to corporations. And corporations, large companies, took this technology and, you know, used it to connect internal networks and to use it to digitize their operations in this sort of primitive way. But, you know, I mean, I think the earliest stuff was really military, because that was the test bed. And I'd say the first deployment of this technology in America, in the civilian world, or against the civilian population, I should say, what happened almost immediately. So in 1969, the ARPANET went online. And that year already, you know, there was a very active anti-war movement and a big movement to stop military research on campuses. You know, students at MIT and Harvard got their hands on a research proposal that talked about creating this Cambridge project, which talking about creating this data technology that could allow analysts to ingest data on people and movements and political movements. And they got their hands on the ARPA proposal, and then in the text of it, it was very clearly a counterinsurgency weapon, a data-based counterinsurgency weapon that its planners wanted to deploy against third world countries where there were insurgent movements. And so back then the students held protests at MIT and against the ARPANET a month before it went online. And they warned that this is going to be used to surveil civilians, and that it was going to be deployed maybe overseas at first, but that it was going to come back very quickly and going to be used against civil rights activists and left-wing movements and progressive movements in general in America. And it was a huge protest. It was written up in the press at the time. It lasted for a month, and there was occupations of MIT of buildings on campus. So it was a pretty big thing, and of course these kids turned out to be right, because 1972, just 3 years after ARPANET went online, it was used to digitize surveillance files that were illegally collected by the army on millions of anti-war protesters and civil rights activists in the 1960s. And the army, Congress forced the army to destroy those files, but instead of destroying them, they actually digitized them and then used the ARPANET to essentially make them permanent, and then make them accessible to the White House, to the NSA, to the FBI, to the CIA, to the Pentagon. And so 3 years after the ARPANET went online, it was used to spy on Americans almost immediately. And so the surveillance aspect of it and the domestic use was there from the beginning.
It started as more of a repository and, I guess, a function of the data rather than the data collection that it has now become on some level, right? And let me ask you this. When we're talking about initially, and particularly in this stage, right, before the model of the sort of, the dumb terminal and the central server is developed, how many people or how many agencies, are actually connected by this?
You're talking about, we're talking about what years now?
I don't know. Like in the late 60s, when you're talking about this data that's fed in there, and is it just at like a couple of the top national security agencies, or are they at universities? Or MIT have a connection to that?
So
it's at some of the top universities, I guess, the technical universities, just how widespread was it at that point?
It's widespread and it expands very quickly because, you have major universities attached to it that are doing, and most of them are doing research on the ARPANET as part of the ARPANET program. And so they have connections to it. You have the Pentagon connections to it. You have an NSA connection to it starting in the early 70s. You have Air Force connection to it that was, I think, almost from the very beginning. And you have other connections to it which are basically unlisted. There are maps published and there are discussions of it, of the different nodes and the expansion of the network. And the main thing is, look, the internet, the ARPANET was created as a general purpose network that could connect any kind of computer, right? And it could also connect to any other kind of network that was based on the same protocol. So you could take the ARPANET, right? And then you can connect it to a different network that ran on the same kind of design. And they could communicate, just like your local network, your local ISP can communicate with an ISP in China, right? Because they function on the same principle, and so they're interconnected. And so what started happening very quickly when the ARPANET design was shown to be very effective was that the NSA and the Pentagon more broadly began to convert their internal networks to the ARPANET design. And so those networks were classified, some of them were not classified, but they could connect to the actual ARPANET. And so they could communicate through the sort of unclassified ARPANET, which was a civilian network because it connected universities, right? And there wasn't a secret network.
Right.
But they could communicate through that network. So two secret networks communicate with each other through the ARPANET. And so there were these other networks that began to be connected to it. And so which is exactly what kind of happens today. You have various portions of the internet, or military networks that are secret and that civilians can't access them, but they are connected to the internet in certain exchanges that are also secret, obviously. Okay. And so look, the Pentagon began to adopt, the internet as its default networking and telecommunications infrastructure almost from the very beginning. And so as soon as it was proven to be effective. And so this is something that's been going on for 50 years.
All right. I have a tangential question. Because this is relevant insofar as I think it undercuts the posing, I think, on some level of the libertarian, to the extent that there's a libertarian ethos in Silicon Valley, and I'm using Silicon Valley broadly speaking.
Of course.
I guess my question is to just sort of expose the sort of hypocrisy of this. Is that had this the network protocols, the networking, the design been developed in the private industry, presumably there wouldn't be people who would spin off of it and then go and start up their own entities, right? I mean, it would have been, someone would have said, this is our technology and you need to do it through us, essentially to be a part of this, right? I mean, we would have had it.
Yes.
And okay. So with that said, let's talk about how this technology does migrate to private corporations as, you know, as we get better, I guess, more advanced technology. And I should also just remind people that the point of this is because the structure from the very beginning defines the way the problems, or defines, I guess, the context in which we have problems with the internet today, right? I mean, this is the point. The DNA was laid there, and because it was used for these purposes, all of its use reflected from there sort of has this DNA in it. Is that a fair?
Yeah. So, yeah. No. Look, that's a fair thing. Look, the internet was developed as a military project, right? To develop new kinds of to use computer technology and networking technology to create a management system for the military that could help them run operations in on a global scale, right? To create a kind of a radar system for the world, the way that you could see an aircraft moving across a radar screen, right? You presumably would want to have the same thing, but for your troops to understand what's going on, to understand all the conflicts in all the different places that America is involved in as an empire, to get a bird's eye view of the world, and that's what it was, that's what the idea was behind it, on a kind of a high level. Of course, the tools at the time did not allow that right away, but that was the driving force, and this technology was built by a military contractor. So right away you had a military design for this technology, or an intent, the reason why it was being funded as a Pentagon project, and then you had it actually being built by a military contractor. And so already there's this private-public aspect to it, right, from the very beginning, that plugs into the military-industrial complex, and that plugs into corporate America, and that plugs into, empire management in the age of the Cold War. And so, yeah, it's there. And look, the internet was privatized starting in the late 80s and it finished in the mid 90s. And that was there was a specific process that actually very few people know about. So the National Science Foundation was essentially tasked with bringing the ARPANET, right, this military network that was still attached to military research, to transfer to the civilian sector. And the way that it did that starting in the late 1980s was to essentially behind closed doors, without really any public debate, come up with a plan that would fund a national internet infrastructure, and then but design it in a way that as soon as it was commercially viable, that is, as soon as there were enough customers out there that could sustain a business model for internet service providers, the National Science Foundation, which is a federal agency, would privatize it. And so that's exactly what happened starting in beginning in the late 80s and concluding in, I think, 1995, when the National Science Foundation finally got out completely of the network. But the foundation of this civilian internet, right, was actually another government network called the NSFNet, the National Science Foundation Network, that was completely funded by the federal government and privatized, and it was that was done explicitly. That was a plan. And I even, in my book, I even talked to a guy who privatized the internet, and I asked him, like, is it safe? Is it fair to call you the man who privatized the internet? And he told me, yeah, it's fair to say that. And we don't even know who this guy is. I mean, ask any American, do you know the name of the guy who privatized the internet? And, you'll probably get a stare back at you like you're fucking insane. Like, what are you talking about? The internet was privatized. It was created by the brilliant guys in Silicon Valley who innovated it out of thin air. But that's exactly what happened. And so There was a couple of steps to it. It began as a military project. The technology was absorbed into operational military networks, and starting in the late 70s, became the foundation of military telecommunication systems. And as that was happening, the project was then handed over to a civilian agency, which funded a national network that connected all these universities and research institutions, and then privatized it to companies that would later be absorbed by the giant telecommunication companies and would become part of the ISPs that we all use today.
And just to sort of give a sense of what the alternate world could have been. I mean, we had a situation where you have these central servers, right, where these are the information repositories, and then we have these terminals that people access this information from afar, as opposed to a disaggregated system where everybody has computing power and there is no central terminal. And we now have that capacity on some level, but we're still sort of the genetic structure, I guess, of the way the internet was set up, where it was sort of terminal based and it was centralized, still remains and is imprinted upon everything. And that is now where we have a situation where, I mean, it seems to me that was the genetic code that has led to the almost the concentration of power with entities like Google or with like Facebook or with the infrastructure itself, where I can't really communicate to anybody on the internet without the government having access, and having access via really two or three companies, essentially, right? I mean, it's not just that the government is eavesdropping; it's that there's such a concentration of entities through which I would communicate to other people, private entities, that the government just needs to go to two or three outlets and say, "Give us what you got."
Exactly. Yeah. Look, I mean, you're totally right. Look, there's a certain DNA in the way that it was the architecture of the network, which was these computers were expensive, and even the way that the network was structured, you know, the routers that controlled the flow of traffic, these are, you know, pretty expensive computers. Obviously, not everyone could own one and have them in their bedroom, and that would be kind of ridiculous because you didn't need that many of them. But the structure of the internet as we have it today is also partially because of the protocols and because of the original design, but also it's political, right? It's very political. And so there could have been a world in which, in the late 80s, when the federal government began to create a civilian national infrastructure, where this wasn't handed over to a bunch of private companies and wasn't designed to be privatized, to be eventually privatized, but would be, I don't know, handed over to the Postal Service or something, or handed over to municipalities, right? Some kind of democratic institution. And public institutions that could control chunks of the network and could oversee those chunks of the network and have power over them, right? And that maybe on a state level, right? I mean, there's a lot of different possibilities, but those things were not discussed because public ownership was not something that was going to be pursued in the Reagan years, right? Especially of a new telecommunications infrastructure that everybody back then knew was going to be a huge moneymaker. Everyone understood in the 80s that the internet, the NSF net, which was being privatized, that is the new profit center, and so this is not going to be given over to some kind of municipal agency, right? It wasn't going to be given to the post office, which Reagan was destroying, right, and gutting, and so at the time, right? So but there are possibilities where the original sort of corporate military structure of the internet could have morphed into something a bit more democratic, right? And but that didn't happen, obviously, because of politics and culture. So that's a very big part of the story of the internet. So it's not just that there was some kind of DNA in the internet, and then that it's immutable, right? You couldn't really change it anymore because that's just how it was. And so we almost have a like a fatalistic view of this. No, I mean, society created this technology, and it has the power to change it. It still does. But just the cultural forces and the political culture of the country, I mean, it was not going to push it in that direction at all, because how could you? all the political alignment was actually privatizing everything and pushing everything to the market sector and gutting public ownership of resources and public and gutting public oversight of democratic oversight of the country, right? So so I think that's a big story that we don't really know about the internet, like basically alternative futures, maybe, you know,
right.
of where this internet could have gone. And this is something that we need to think about, because I think, I mean, we shouldn't be fatalistic about this stuff, right? You know, I mean, the internet is dominated today by giant corporations and is dominated by spies, not because of some preordained thing from God, right? But because our society is dominated by these forces. And so the internet is a reflection of our society. And so as long as our larger society is dominated by the military industrial complex and is dominated by corporations, where everything's privately owned, the internet is going to be a reflection of that. So it's not really surprising, right, that it would take this form, because everything else in our country it takes this form as well.
Well,
not just the internet.
I will also say too, and you know, I think people could accuse me of having this on the brain a little bit, because of there's been a resurgence of research and advocacy for a return to our pre-Borkian antitrust laws. But, you know, were we still in a pre-Robert Bork era of antitrust, Google would not exist as it exists now. Facebook would not exist now. The fact that AT&T and Verizon and one or two other players have the ability to basically vacuum up and a couple of cable operators, I mean, to the extent that they're not part of Verizon or AT&T now, that all this information is basically goes through one or two entities would not necessarily be the case. And I guess the point is that we need to understand that this was simply a choice and not one that is etched in stone. You can easily break this up into more disaggregated parts. I wanted to get also to, but we just have a minute here, that not mm-hmm. only is this a story of sort of the broad structure of the internet and that it was and its development that has seemingly limited us in the way that we see it today, but the story of Tor. Just tell people that, because I was not familiar with, and I think people are familiar with what Tor is. It's basically, I don't know if it's a VPN, but it's a way of anonymously or presumably anonymously interacting with the web. And you have a different perspective on the way this was developed.
Look, yeah, Tor is a kind of VPN. It's like a super VPN. It's a supposedly decentralized VPN. So as a VPN, you know, you still go through some company that, you know, owns some server, and you're using that server to basically to front for you, right? So the outside world only sees the server that you're sending all your. It's like a shell, right? That you're communicating with the world through. And so Tor is a decentralized shell. So it every time you connect to it, it routes your signal through this kind of random network of other Tor hosts, and so presumably that makes it very difficult to find out who you are, because there isn't like a single entity that you can go to and spy on or request records from, right? And then so that your internet activity can be traced. And so there's a couple of hops that it does that's supposed to completely anonymize you. But, you know, the thing – so this tool was seen, you know, just a few years ago as the savior of the internet. So after Edward Snowden came on the scene with his NSA leaks that showed that the internet has become this giant surveillance machine and that everybody's involved, you know, the NSA and the biggest Silicon Valley companies are in cahoots with each other and they're spying on you. You know, Tor was presented as the solution, and as a solution to government surveillance. Edward Snowden heavily promoted it. Laura Poitras, of course, who made Citizen 4, the Academy Award-winning film, documentary about Snowden, you know, promoted it and said she wouldn't have been able to make the film without it. Glenn Greenwald promoted, everybody promoted, all these big journalists promoted it as a way to protect yourself online from the government, from government surveillance. Well, you know, as I outline in my book, actually is 100% funded by the U.S. government. And it is actually funded in large part by the Pentagon and in large part by an organization that had been spun off from the CIA and the State Department as well. So it's funded by three main entities, and all of them are part of the national security state. And that Tor is actually itself a government contractor, a military contractor that has military contracts with the Pentagon. And so, you know, part of, I don't know how much time we have, but I mean, part of what this shows to me, you know, and what I
use. It's a honeypot, right? I mean, it's basically, I mean, it's, you know,
basically,
just quickly, yeah, it was developed.
It was developed
for essentially the CIA to go about their work online anonymously. And then they were like, well, because it is, we need to actually make this a service so that people will outside of the CIA will use it so that it won't indicate that someone from the CIA is using it. In other words, like it was exclusively used by the CIA.
Yes.
So you could tell like, oh, someone who's using Tor has been here. That must be CIA. But if we make it a public service, essentially, then we are hiding. We can use the service without identifying ourselves. And I mean, how much
hiding in plain sight?
How were people not aware of this? Right? Like, I mean, there were like.
I mean, it's ideological, man. You know, it's really ideological. People were aware of it, but there's this, because if you go and if you drill down into Tor's website and like look at, you know, they're like, oh yes, we're taking a little bit of money from the government, but they say that, you know, they. Okay, look, they weren't aware of it. People were not aware of the extent of the government funding. Oh. Basically, Tor lied, and Tor misled its users, telling people that we receive a portion of our funds from this U.S. government agency that funds the Voice of America, they said, right? So they try to make it as totally, you know, inconsequential as this sort of, I don't know, just this, you know, they just care about internet freedom. That's all.
Right. They don't a really State Department project anyway. That is supposedly going to help dissidents
even,
in China. Essentially.
Yeah. And then, they didn't really even talk about the State Department. They talked about the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which oversees American foreign broadcasting operations. But what I did is I drilled into their tax documents, which they have to publicly disclose because they're a federal contractor. And so they actually have to disclose, a pretty detailed reports about the nature of their financing, and I found out that, like, in their documents, actually they don't really indicate where they're getting the contract to government entity. It's because it's passed through private contractors. So, you know, it's Pentagon funding or contract comes through the Stanford Research Institute (SRI), which actually was one of the main researchers on the ARPANET. Back in the day, it helped create the internet. It was one of the main groups that helped create a lot of the technology that's connected to the internet. And so SRI, but it's a Pentagon contract that they get. And so they tried to hide the extent of their funding. And so when I added it all up and I went through all the years that I could get my hands on financial documents, I found out that U.S. government funding adds up to anywhere between 90 to like 98% of their budget.
Wow. That's crazy.
It's crazy. Yeah, it's insane. And so that is, you know, that is what really I think, because when I first started reporting that, even before I wrote, started working on my book, that is what got me, you know, basically, you know, attacked in a way that I've never experienced as a journalist. I mean, as an investigative journalist, you know, who went after the Koch brothers, I've seen my fair share of attacks and smears and threats and things like that. But I was not prepared for what was coming my way when I began to expose what is essentially an intelligence operation, right?
Wow.
To mask privacy technology All right, to weaponize privacy technology.
Well, I'll tell you something. When you lay it out, it makes absolute sense that that's exactly, you know, what you would anticipate an agency like that would do, right? Like, we're going to develop the privacy technology so that you can use our technology, so you don't really have any privacy. And so, let me ask you this: in closing. Is there anything as, like, is there any ability in using, and you have a similar story in terms of Signal. We don't have time to get into it, but people can read the book. But is there any real way to have the level of privacy that one would expect on the internet, you know, whether it's people using the internet to organize or what, or is it just you can use it, but be aware that, you know, you're not shielded.
Look. Ultimately, you don't. There's no way you're going to protect yourself from something like the NSA or the CIA, right? If they want to surveil you, they're going to surveil you. But I think, you know, the NSA and the CIA or the government surveillance has been made into this huge problem. But actually, it's a small subset of a larger, bigger problem, which is corporate surveillance and private surveillance, which I think is much more on an everyday level for our society is actually much more problematic. Or the two are connected, right? And this is corporate surveillance, because look, we use corporate networks to communicate. The entire internet is private property owned by a few companies, and these companies make their money by spying on us, right?
Yep.
So when you have all the money and all the infrastructure controlled by these companies, whose business model depends on surveilling our every move online, right, and offline, what kind of privacy can you expect, really? And so my answer to this is that privacy, for the most part, is a political problem. You're not going to protect yourself technically from surveillance of the NSA, because its job is to break any kind of technical protection, right, and to spy on everything. That's his mandate. And you're especially not going to be protecting yourself from government surveillance if most of the privacy technology is funded by the government.
Right.
Privacy is political, right? It's not about that how information is collected necessarily. It's about how it's used, and if it's used against us in some way by powerful interests, whether they're corporate interests or government interests, right? It's about how information is leveraged to influence us and to affect us somehow. And so that problem is political.
And that's one that we can make a choice on. Yasha Levine, the book is Surveillance Valley, The Secret Military History of the Internet. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. It was a pleasure.
All right. We will put a link to that book at majority.fm. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. Special bonus, Cliff Schechter is going to be telling us about an organization, Ohioans for Economic Opportunity, started in Ohio. And there are similar organizations around the country that are targeting Republican congressmen in this 2018 election. Quick break, and Cliff will be here for a couple minutes to tell us about it. We'll be right back.
Thanks for all your show notes. This is how we feel. Comes in next to me. Pour yourself some tea. Just like grandma made when combines me. Things were better then. Once but never again. We've all left the damn land.
We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, a special. This is a... Oh, wait a second. I should do this. Hold on one second. This is a special report, ladies and gentlemen. We have a special report from our Ohio correspondent, Cliff Schechter. Also, now the CEO of Ohioans for Economic Opportunity, Cliff. What is this?
This is Cliff Schechter reporting from the hinterland,
from the real heartland of the country. So wait,
that's right.
So what do you got going here?
All right, so let's talk about it. First of all, thank you for having me on. Also, on a non-Friday. So I feel even more special.
That's why we did the breaking news. That's why we did the breaking news thing.
Well, so I started a group, and the purpose of it, even outside of its very Koch brothers-like name, which is fun, is to point out we have a congressman here. His name is Steve Chabot, and he is incredibly right-wing on everything you can possibly imagine. And, you know, he voted to get rid of health care 50 times. He voted for the crappy Trump, he was supporting the crappy Trump bill to get rid of, first of all, to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, eventually voted for that terrible tax bill to get rid of the individual mandate, which is driving up premiums nearly 20%, not just here in Ohio, but Virginia has already announced this in Colorado and a number of other states. And so we are doing a grassroots effort. Also, we've raised some money and we're going to be pointing out his record on health care and taxes, because that's important. And a lot of people don't know these things because news is crazy and there's a lot going on out there. And, you know, we think that people are still voting on and making decisions on kitchen table issues. And this guy has literally gone out of his way to make their lives more difficult. And it's part of a broader effort, to be clear. There's about 20 districts around the country where folks are doing similar activities, you know, mostly in swing seats, to point this out. And I think it's kind of fun for your listeners to know, because it is going there. There's some going on in Virginia and in California and a number of other states where there are incumbents like Chabot here, incumbents in these other districts, who voted in the same manner that he did. And so we're making those very important kitchen table arguments. So there you go.
And so what, is there a way for people to get involved in these things? Are you doing, is it basically media buys, or are there other, arrows in your quiver?
There are other arrows in our quiver, because we believe strongly in grassroots. I'm not saying, you know, we've raised actually about $1 million. So we're going to be doing, there'll probably be some TV, although we'll target that where we'd like it, and some of the kind of media buys. But a lot of this is really just showing up at events, making sure to follow the good congressman around and ask him questions, creative ways to find media. For example, we created a website and a Twitter account that people can follow called The Chabot Habit. It's all about all Chabot's bad habits, like, you know, voting for taxes to go up, actually, on many middle-class people here, and voting for an age tax that literally would tax people as they got older on their health care. And again, the individual mandate, we're going to find out in Ohio, as a number of other states are finding out, where our premiums are headed. And we know the estimate right now is that they're going to go up 17% because of getting rid of the individual mandate and other acts of what we like to call sabotage.
Nice. So, can we get
like
a little?
Is it, like
isn't there? We should have a little musical sting for that. The Beastie Boys, right?
We'll come up with something.
So wait.
I'm thinking I'm going to get that song going when we go to some events. But so, no, go ahead. Ask me.
Well, okay. So wait, do you have $1 million for that specific race? I mean, that's or is this across those? I think you said 13 districts.
Nope, this specific race.
Wow. And so that's a lot of expenditures to come into a congressional race, isn't it?
It is. But I think a lot of people out there are sensing we could take back Congress. We are a C4 group, so of course we don't tell people how to vote. We just like them to know the positives and negatives of the representatives. They should know
I see what you're saying.
But But I mean, the point is that in all seriousness, is that a lot of people realize that this is an election where a lot of things could change. And for as far as we're concerned, people should be educated about those choices. And this has been a swing district for a long time. And Steve Chabot has voted like it's one of these plus 20 or 30 Republican districts. I mean, you know, top 10 guy in taking NRA money in the House. A top guy in anything that would have to do with mitigating the effects of global warming. You can find him on the other side. Again, healthcare, taxes, like up and down. He's a virulent, like vicious anti-choicer who runs around screaming about abortion being murder. I mean, he's just terrible on all fronts. He doesn't represent, he's even close to representing the district. He's not a center-right Republican. He's a right-wing loon. He's also pretty racist and xenophobic and loves Donald Trump, votes with him 95% of the time. So the view is here, as it is in other districts across the country, we've had conversations with people, and a lot of us came to conclusions who were based in some of these areas that we should put together a project, a little bit of a plan in each of our districts to do this. And we did, and thankfully we've been able to raise some money. And, you know, so yeah, we have enough money for TV, and we have enough money for direct mail and digital and some of that stuff. But we, you know my background. I believe strongly in earned media and grassroots organizing. And so we've already shown up in various events where he's been. We've created our own events. We're going to have some town halls here where we're going to discuss these issues. I can't say names yet because they're not confirmed, but we have one or two semi-interesting, semi-famous people who may host these. And so we're pretty excited. Actually,
so as a 501c4, you're not you can't coordinate with any campaign. But so let me ask you this: you are
that's correct.
But the idea is you're educating people in your district about Chabot's habits, as it were. Give us a breakdown. I know this obviously it's not particularly relevant to you as a 501c4 directly, because again, you're not advocating for a specific candidate. But give us a breakdown.
No, I would never do that.
Knowing that we live in the world that we live in, with people's priors, their partisan, there's confirmation bias. When you look at your district, what is the partisan index? So, in other words, how much confirmation bias will there be when you start letting people know about Chabot's habits?
Well, so this is depending upon recent rating changes, whatever. It's about a plus six Republican district. They gerrymandered to make it more Republican than it was before after 2010, but. This is an interesting stat there. It has one of the largest African American populations of any Republican held district in the country. It's 22% African American. When you add Hispanic and Asian, you get over 30% of the district. And it's one of these districts that has suburbs that have a lot of well educated folks of the kind that, even if they're independent or Republican, have been horrified by what they see as the attack on science and progress and anything logical, let's just say, by the far right. So it's been trending away from him. And and not that I'm advocating, well, all I can advocate is Cliff Schechter, that people vote for his opponent, which I will, not as part of my organization. But his opponent is a young guy named Aftab Perival, who, I mean, literally could not be the embodiment, a better embodiment of exactly the opposite of this old right-wing white guy. It's, you know, Aftab is somebody who's parents immigrated here, first generation here. He's half Indian, half Tibetan, you know, went to Ohio State and then got a law degree and went out and helped people and beat an incumbent with a very popular name around here to become our clerk of courts last year in what was considered a huge upset. And Public Policy Polling, which is a pretty trustworthy polling outfit, had the race literally almost tied. They had Aftab up, I think, by 1 point. I think it was 43-42. So, I mean, there's no doubt that this is a district where how Steve Chabot has voted should play into whether he can hold on to his seat, you know. And again, this is going on around the country. And taking off my Ohioans for Economic Opportunity hat or Chabot Habit hat, putting on my Cliff Schechter hat, if you will, for the Majority Report, we only need 23 seats.
Right.
And then Democrats, so when you're in as far as my account goes, of people doing things like this in 19 districts around the country right now that have incumbents
no one's doing these in open districts or whatever. It's districts where there are incumbents who need to be held accountable for how they voted and how they, and let me go beyond this, the political of it, just in the sort of angry activist side of me. That 22% of the African American part of his district, he never even sort of utters the words African American. I mean, they are completely ignored. He doesn't know they exist. He pays no attention. He never shows up to neighborhoods in their neighborhoods in the district. They literally, it's the thing about gerrymandering that angers us all, when certain people just have absolutely zero representation who really need it, because there are some parts of that district that are really hurting. And so we're going to do our best to get the message out and make sure people know how important it is that they get registered and they learn their options. And that's what we're doing.
Let me ask you this.
I think, again, go ahead.
If we just got a minute, but if somebody wanted to get involved in the stuff either that you're doing in Ohio or wanted to get involved in it in the other districts around the country, just to, you know, educate their voters, is there a central website or how would they go about doing that?
Well, so here's what I would say. Yes, you can go to our site, which is oheconomicopportunity.org. I'll say it again. It's oheconomicopportunity.org. We have an email sign up. You can sign up there. You should be able to leave a comment, and you can sort of let us know if you want to help us and be an activist in this area. Great. If there's other areas you'd like to do that, we will absolutely be happy to pass your information on. We are reaching out to get people's stories who have either lost their health care or may lose their health care with these premium hikes, and those kinds of things, so that we can share. So obviously, but even if you don't have a story and you just want to be an activist, absolutely go to the website, or you can always, if you know where to find me on Twitter, at Cliff Schechter, tweet at me, and I will point you to the website. If you didn't hear that again, oheconomicopportunity.org, or I'll point you to other groups that are doing the same thing. If you're in Virginia, or in Colorado, or in California, or Florida, or numerous other places where these activities are taking place, I'm happy to, because the more people that get out there, knock on doors, go up to events with signs and do the rest, as we know, the energy leads to more people being involved in the process. And when more people are involved, we win.
Great. All right, Cliff. Glad to hear it. Appreciate the special midweek appearance.
And I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to share this information. Thank you very much, buddy.
Hi, that's been Cliff Schechter from oheconomicopportunity.org. Thanks, Cliff. Talk to you soon, buddy.
Thanks, buddy.
Bye.
Yeah, bye.
All right, folks, there you have it. People are starting to mobilize. Apparently, there is a big election happening in the fall, and people might want to get involved. And I mean, just for a moment, just to put into context, the stories that we see today about the clown prince. Apparently, that's what that guy, was it Nader, called him? The clown prince. This is like no honor amongst thieves, ladies and gentlemen. That's the problem. You get in, you get in bed with the fleas. You're gonna, whatever it is, whatever that saying is.
It's working, and it's very exciting.
They call him the clown prince in the context of the negotiations with the crown prince. And, but just understand, a Democratic Congress, House, is going to do one thing, right? One, they'll organize, they'll get ready. It's going to do, well, I should say two things. The only active thing that they're going to be able to do, other than, pass legislation that's going to die in the Senate, assuming the Democrats don't capture the Senate, is it's going to stop any legislative activity by the Republicans, including the CRAs, Congressional Review Acts, which are very dangerous. and it's going to start investigations. That's it. That's all you can expect over the next 2 years if the Democrats take the House in the fall. If they don't, not only will you see an acceleration of legislative activity, because the Republicans, that they're playing with House money at that point, as far as they're concerned, but you're also going to see a higher concentration of Trumpistas in the House than you have now, right? There's not going to be all the Charlie Dents and all the moderates, and I have that in quotes, all the people who are in you know, semi-moderate districts, they're gone. If the Republicans control, it is going to be pure Trumpistas. And everybody's going to want a little taste. Everybody's going to be a Devin Nunes. And the level of corruption you see is going to be undergirded by the House. So 2018 elections are hugely important. I mean, to the extent that we're not spiraling into an abyss anyways, let's put it that way. If it is the case that we're not, these are going to be hugely important.
The abyss is calling.
There you go.
Be ready.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support to exist. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. In other words, you would join the majority report at jointhemajorityreport.com. And in doing so, you're supporting The Daily Show. We say thank you by giving you bonus content every day. And then you're also part of a very elite group of people who may be activated at one point. I'm not, you know, I don't...
The best people.
I don't want to get cryptic, but we haven't activated, you know, people like for... The ultimate calling in the first 7 years, but one never knows. Who knows what we could do? But join themajorityreport.com. And don't forget, obviously, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate using coupon code majority. And if you can't afford a membership, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will never turn away someone from the fun half because of finances. Also, if you look at your calendar, you will notice that today is May 22nd, but it's a Tuesday. And on Tuesdays, The Michael Brooks Show goes live. And it goes live at 7 p.m. Eastern on our YouTube channel and over our stream, which is available via the website, majority.fm, or our app at majorityapp.com. And tonight on TMBS...
Geneticist Eric Turkheimer on Class and IQ, and journalist Nida Khan.
And also, don't forget you on via the Patreon device, patreon.com/TheAntifada, you can hear The Antifada, wherein Jamie co-hosts and with Sean and Natasha Leonard this week, right?
Hell yeah. Yeah, she's got a book coming out on violence and how it's framed in media and culture and politics. And we had a really good conversation about it.
And you can check that out via patreon.com/TheAntifada.
And your podcast app.
And your podcast
app. It's in the iTunes.
Oh, right. And iTunes, of course. Yes, you can sign up on iTunes for both TMBS and The Antifada. And, of course, Majority Report. All right, quick break. See you in the fun half.